Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, he was the big star of the recent US election. He's the number-crunching journalist who for decades has taught us how America elects its politicians. With the help of his trusted magic wall, he's the go-to guy for election watchers, political junkies, and just about anyone with a fleeting interest in what makes the United States tick. When asked on Twitter earlier this month by Lisa McGee, creator of Derry Girls, "Is John King Irish yet?" he replied, "Always." And I am, of course, speaking of John King, CNN's chief national correspondent, who joins me now on the line from Washington, D.C. Good morning, John.
Good morning to you. I'm grateful for your time.
Oh, well, we're really grateful to chat to you. Listen, first of all, congrats on your incredible election coverage. Everyone in Ireland was addicted to it. How was it for you?
It was exciting. It was exhausting. It was exhilarating. It was unprecedented because we were having this election, obviously, in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, which made voting very different than ever before. And plus, it's the Trump administration, so everything's a little wacky anyway. This was my ninth presidential election, and I've had a few wild ones, including the Bush-Gore recount in 2000, when Ross Perot ran as a third-party candidate back in the 1990s. You think that, you know, it'll never be that nutty again, and lo and behold, it was a crazy, I was going to say election night, it was a crazy election week.
The memes were very funny. Even TikTok, they kept saying, you know, "Has John King slept at all? Did you actually get any sleep?"
Not much. Maybe next week. Tuesday was election day. We didn't call the election until Saturday. I was getting about 2.5-3 hours a night. That's okay.
We also love the fact that you were so into your math, or maths as we call it. And I think at one stage you say you owe the nuns at St. Mark's School and Boston Latin School for that.
I do. I grew up in a great Irish Catholic neighborhood in Boston, Dorchester section of Boston. The nuns, they were tough on me. It's one of those things, it's funny, you don't appreciate it at the time. Actually, you grumble about it at the time and you complain about it at the time. And then later in life, you realize, it was worth it. Although I didn't feel that way as a young boy, I'll tell you that.
Even the way you write the number 8.
I caused an international controversy with my writing of the number 8. I do it both ways. Sometimes I do it as I was taught, and sometimes I do it with the double circles on top. And of all the things that become social media controversies, how I write the number 8, if you notice, my writing is pretty messy, so it's kind of embarrassing anyway.
So how Irish is John King of Dorchester, Massachusetts?
John King is 100% Irish. I mean, I'm Irish-American, I guess. You know, my dad's family, it was very proudly Irish. My dad used to fancy himself as someone who could sing. In our neighborhood, it was mostly Irish Catholic growing up. A little mix of others, but it was an important tradition in my neighborhood. And actually, the most heartwarming thing for me of this whole experience has been, you know, I have a cousin there who I talk with on Facebook every now and then. But just stirring up memories of the family and conversations among different cousins who are all around the world, and all around the United States, that part has been heartwarming. The excitement about the election is flattering when people mention me personally, but I take that much more as young people were interested in the election. International audiences were interested in the election. Activism of people here in the United States, and I think interest of people around the world, and will Trump win a second term? What will the United States take a different course? I think all that was very important. And then for me, I get this great little family conversation out of it as well, which has been heartwarming.
Tell me, is it your grandfather, Christopher, or Festy King, who came from Ballyconneely or Dunlochan? Tell me about him.
I have very faint memories of my grandfather because he died just before I turned 5. But I do remember he was in a soldier's home in Chelsea, Massachusetts, which is a town just north of Boston. And my dad would go visit him on the weekends and bring him groceries. And I believe there might have been whiskey involved on occasion in those deliveries. And my dad would take me for the ride. And that was always a treat. He had big, strong hands. That's what I remember most. He would always put his hand on your shoulder or his hand on the top of your head and rub your head and turn your neck a little bit. And like my dad, he had these giant, strong hands. And he always had a little scally cap that he had. And in his little room at the soldier's home, he always had a big bowl of oranges. And so I've always associated the smell of oranges with my grandfather since I was a child. My dad's name was Richard, but everybody in Dorchester called him Chris because he was the spitting image of his father. Even though my dad's formal name was Richard King, nobody called him Richard. My mother did when she was mad at him, but everybody called him Chris.
And I think your grandmother Bridget Joyce, obviously becoming Bridget King. She was also from Connemara, John, and she, I think she emigrated to Boston in about 1909.
Yeah, she actually came a couple of years ahead of my grandfather. And the Joyces and the Kings here in the United States had, you know, obviously close relationships and a marriage. And back there, they did as well. I never knew my grandmother. My dad always spoke about her as the boss, though. His father, Festy or Christy, was, again, my memories are faint, but my dad always spoke of him as a very strong, assertive, powerful, you know, head of the family. And then he would wink and say, you know, my mom ran the show. My parents died young, too. And one of the sad things for all of us was that we didn't really know our grandparents very well. And so that, again, has been a heartwarming part of this exposure and, you know, my little 5 minutes of fame, if we want to call it that, is that it's stirring up all these great family histories and getting, you know, my siblings and I to look at it and my cousin Jackie over there in Ireland. So it's been great.
Yeah. And actually, your cousin Jackie, I think she seems like she's the family historian. She's been telling the Irish Times here. I think about your great grandmother, Kate Little King, who was Christie's mother, your grandfather. I mean, have you known much about your family tree and the great characters along in it? I think she was one of 24 children.
That isn't that wild. I'm one of seven. And so you think when you have seven siblings, five boys and two girls, you think there'll never be anything as chaotic as that in your entire life. And then to hear, you know, your great grandmother had 24. It's amazing to me, which obviously means she was tough as could be. I always joke that my two sisters are the toughest women on earth because they had to put up with, you know, five pain in the you-know-what brothers.
Yeah.
I knew a little about this. One of my younger brothers works with Jackie quite a bit. He's done much more than I have to retrace all the documents, the census documents and the military documents and everything. I'm frankly, you know, embarrassed to say sometimes I'm a little behind him on getting into the details of it. And so that is my big mission out of this election is I keep telling Jackie I'm going to come visit as soon as I can. And I want to learn more about it. And when I've seen the picture before, but when I saw the picture again of my great grandmother outside the house, the family resemblance is just striking. It's like looking at my father. My father was a very hardworking man, and we didn't have much growing up in terms of money, but we had everything, right? We had a family, we had vibrance, we had song, we had love, we had laughter. And you realize when you get a little bit older that that's really what matters, and anything else that you have is just extra. And so the hard work ethic that that was ingrained in us as children, now I have a much better understanding of where it came from.
And Jackie, your cousin, says there's going to be a pint waiting for you in Kyo's Pub in Ballyconneely. Do you think you'll get there anytime soon? Obviously post-COVID, but would you like to come?
I would like to come, and I just would tell the barkeep right now it better be more than one pint. I get thirsty. I've been to Ireland several times, but always for work. I covered the White House for a long time, so I was there with President Clinton, and I was there with President Bush. But I've never been there as a visitor and as a tourist and as an Irish American to just retrace my roots. And that's my fault. And so, again, one of the great seeds planted in me from this election and the interest in Ireland is to make sure I get there, not just once, but get there, begin the journey soon.
And as you say, John, you've covered a lot of elections, but I suppose how broadcasters like you covered this election, kind, it was particularly important given how divided your country is right now, not to mention, I suppose, all the accusations of media bias, fake news, voting irregularities. And I noticed, and it was really interesting, you appeared to give regular warnings and you appealed for patience.
I think it's very important. Number one, the President of the United States, this is a political strategy. I find it sad, but it's his political strategy, is to attack our business and especially attack anybody who calls him out. And it's, again, it's sad, but the President of the United States, the current president, lies and lies a lot. And that is supported by fact checks. That's not a personal opinion. And so we knew coming into the election, number one, that he was going to say things that might not be true. And number two, we knew the results were going to come in very differently than any other election, just because different states were doing it different ways. Because of the pandemic, some people voted by mail, a great number of people voted by mail, which is unusual in many of the United States. Then you had people who voted early, and then you had people who showed up on election day. And so we knew the states were going to be overwhelmed in counting the votes, and some states decided to do it in different order. In the state of Ohio or the state of Texas, Joe Biden jumped out to a big early lead, and Democrats across the United States were so happy. And I just had to keep saying, calm down, be patient. They're counting the votes. And so I thought it was very important to explain to people this was going to be unlike any other election. And, you know, what you're seeing early on is certainly real, but it's only a small piece of the puzzle. And it's going to take us hours and maybe even days to get enough votes before we can be contextual about what we're really seeing.
Are you happy that media outlets mostly avoided the rush to call races this time around? I mean, that's a practice we here in Ireland find, we find it quite baffling.
I join you in finding it baffling. I'm conservative by nature anyway, and I think there's great theater in a close election, right? Why would you want to end the play in the middle? And so there's always been what I find to be silly, and there's much less of it now. The 2000 election, the Bush versus Gore, when you know it looked like Gore won, then Bush won, and several networks were embarrassed by making calls that turned out to be wrong. I hope we've all learned a lesson from that. And I know at CNN, I'm very proud of our group. We are very cautious. We do project states when we have enough data to tell us, even though there's still votes to be counted, you know, statistical probabilities and the like. But we're a lot more cautious. And in this election, just because of how everything was so unusual and how, again, how different states were doing it in different ways, we just made it our rule coming in that we're going to have caution as a standard. We're going to have very clear standards and metrics about how we make decisions, and we will not bend those rules, even if things are obvious. It was obvious to us on Friday that Biden was going to win, but we had to wait till more votes came in on Saturday to make the call because we had put these rules down. We had tested them for months, and you can't bend them. It's just not right.
We were all fascinated as well by the detail at your fingertips and I suppose the intimate knowledge you seem to have of your country down to county level. Where do you draw that knowledge from?
Experience. I've been very lucky, blessed in both my job here at CNN and before that I worked for 12 years as a print reporter for the Associated Press Wire Service. And I've been very lucky, and this is my 9th presidential election. This one was very unusual in that I had very little travel, in part because of my job is a little different and in part because of COVID. But in the previous elections, I've traveled constantly. And in the first 5, I traveled all the time. I was a reporter, you know, on the campaign plane. And so I've been to all 50 states many times, and I've been to some of them 20 or 30 times because of campaigns. And a lot of those counties that we know are the key counties that decide elections, I've spent time there year after year after year because those are the places I visit when I can get out in America. Part of it is it's the gift of my work, and it's been a blessing in that, as I said, I grew up in Dorchester, and we didn't have much money growing up, so we didn't get to travel all that much. And so when I first started traveling and was essentially introduced to America, it's an incredibly diverse country and politically and economically, and it's a fascinating experience. And so when you see where my hands are going on the map is where I've lived my life, if you will. You know, so it's a good experience.
I think I read ahead of this election, did you say you read and studied census and state voting economic data to understand population trends?
Yes, because America is changing so much. You have some states that are growing in their population, and sometimes that's people moving to, say, a new medical center. So it's people with college education. In other places, you have a lot of people moving away from rural areas because globalization, the internet, Amazon has taken away, you know, mom and pop retail establishments. And so everyone, you know, where you used to have Main Street small towns and you had a pharmacy and a little grocery store and a 5 and 10, you know, hardware store, a lot of those have been decimated by Amazon and Walmart and the big box stores. And so people are moving more to the suburbs, and that changed just how they vote. Even though I could say, you know, I've covered 9 presidential elections, so I know what's going to happen. Well, that's only about half true. You can experience helps you with some things, but as the population changes and the economy changes, you have to track the shifts because many of our states, look at what Joe Biden just did. He's winning in Georgia. Not since 1992 has a Democrat won there. He just won Arizona. Not since 1996 has a Democrat won there. So as population shift and as the economy changes, politics change as well.
Tell me about your magic wall. Look, it's been an election fixture for many years, but this year, like, it just seemed to break through hugely. Why do you think it resonated so much with people this time round?
I think in part because there was higher interest in the election, just because Trump does, as I always say, Trump puts everything on steroids. There was such high intensity about, you know, will he win a second term? Can Biden win? Then the complexity of the election, I think, made being able to walk through the map even more important than it would be in normal years. And we also had some, I think, some pretty cool technological upgrades so that it was capable of doing things and showing some things, unlike we've done in the past. So we had some new twist to it. I also think because, Miriam, there was such high intensity anxiety among many Americans about the election, the fact that they have come to know the magic wall and I'm going to be there on election night. I was laughing. It was like I must be a comfortable pair of slippers or something that people just thought, yeah, it's like if I'm going to be nervous, I'm going to go to my comfort blanket or my comfort slippers and watch this.
It's amazing. I was thinking as well, and speaking to my own producers about this. I mean, how much work goes into feeding that amount of information? Obviously, you've got loads of it in your brain, but a lot of production must go into a wall like that.
The software writing, so that we can explain demographics, show where, you know, where are the highest COVID infection rates in the United States? Where are the highest unemployment rates in the United States? Where are there higher populations of African Americans or Latinos or, you know, the Trump base, you know, white people without college degrees? That's all software. So you can build a demographic map to show certain trends in the United States. But on election night, when it's just votes coming in live, we have no control over that. That's a live data feed. And I can be talking about a state that's blue because the Democrats leading. And then as I'm talking, it changes to red. I have to react to that. That's the best part. Election night's like being on a roller coaster with a blindfold. You have no idea where you're going. And you just have to navigate the map. And it's great.
And a lot of people, though, it's not me just saying it, they all said you were incredibly fluent. And no matter how often Wolf might occasionally Wolf Blitz or, you know, interrupt with new news, you just stayed quite calm. Like, are you actually that calm as a broadcaster?
Well, you know, I'm told I did my research on you, too. And I'm told that you're like the premier broadcaster in Ireland and you're the best. Someone described you as the Oprah of Ireland to me, one of my colleagues. And so, you know, when you're doing something live, it can get chaotic. And I think any great athlete says this as well. You try to slow it down. Right. So that you can deal with the chaos. Wolf's been a colleague for a long time. I treat him like a brother. He does have to jump in sometimes. The control room is telling him, do this, do that, do this, do that. I try when I go out there to just remember that, you know, this is a little confusing to some people. I talk fast. Too often I speak way too quickly. So I try to just get a little zen, if you will, and try to go as slow as possible, be as clear as possible. But I'm not perfect. You get caught up in the excitement sometimes.
It's been a challenging decade for what people now call mainstream media. Look, CNN, your own organization, others like the BBC, New York Times, as I said earlier, have been dubbed fake news by President Trump. Do you believe now, though, maybe that there is a renewed appetite for quality journalism and impartial public service coverage?
I do, without a doubt. And our ratings during election week and during the COVID pandemic back that up. And it's not just CNN's ratings, just the interest in news, the traffic to credible, reputable mainstream media websites, and not just in the United States, but around the world. You see the traffic up, the interest up, because this is something that, whether it's the COVID pandemic or a, you know, fundamentally changing American presidential election, people want they want information they can trust. And yes, does that mean we're not going to come under attack anymore? Absolutely not. I think President Trump, when he's in retirement as president, will continue this because it's part of his political strategy. And he wants to leave open the possibility of a comeback. And guess what? It worked for him. So there will be, you know, thousands of imitators. Other people will try to follow the same political strategy to success. That always happens. So we will continue to be under attack. And what I try to tell people around here is that don't get too excited about that. Don't get angry. Don't take the fight. Don't fight fire with fire. Fight fire with facts. Just be credible at what you do. Defend your brand. Defend any individual broadcaster or reporter has to defend his or her brand and then defend your company's brand. Fact check things clearly and meticulously. If you do make a mistake, be transparent and say, I'm wrong. I trust the common sense of hardworking people, whether it's here in the United States or around the world, that over time they will figure it out. Sometimes they get duped by political figures that they decide, you know, for whatever reason to follow. But over time, most hardworking people will revert. Gravity will bring them back to common sense and decency.
We now expect the Electoral College, of course, to confirm Joe Biden as president. How big a shift in policy and tone do you expect from his presidency, John?
Tone will be night and day. I don't think we'll wake up every day wondering what the president is going to tweet and who he is going to anger. You know, Trump is essentially a human chainsaw on Twitter. He just every day just, you know, breaks things. So I think that will be very different. Although I also think that's a challenge for Joe Biden, is whether you like or don't like Donald Trump, he's a very effective communicator. He's very effective at taking command of the news cycle. Joe Biden will have to find a different way to do that, but he's a very different person. How he treats people is very different. So I do think you'll see much more an air of decency, an air of respect, an air of common courtesy than you do in the Trump age. From a policy perspective, both in the United States and the world, it's going to be dramatic. He's going to try to, you know, address climate change, which here in the United States will be a tough political sledding, but he'll rejoin the Paris Climate Accords. He will reboost the NATO alliance, something President Trump walked away from. He'll have a tougher stance toward Russia, something President Trump staff and team always wanted to do, but the president himself was not very interested in. So I think on any number of issues, Biden will be night and day. And I think on big issues here in the United States, he's still going to have a very evenly divided Congress. So it will be tough to get things done. But Trump was not a policy guy. Trump is more of a persona, more of a, you know, the Republican Party has become more of a personal party. The Republican Party used to be, you know, lower taxes, strong military. It became much more about the personal Trump brand. The Democratic Party, I think, will, whether it's on climate change, the minimum wage, and issues like that, try to get back to bread and butter working class issues in the United States. Again, whether he can tell them to Congress, that's still an open question.
It's interesting, though, John, you mentioned earlier how much you've traveled around your country, and that's given you this huge bedrock of knowledge. But over 70 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. And do you understand why they did that and the importance, I suppose, of people respecting that vote?
I think the respect part is critical. I'm glad you used that word. So there are some Democrats who think, you know, all of Trump's supporters are these racist or xenophobic or nationalist. No, there's a slice of that, without a doubt. We can't ignore that. But it's only a slice. These are doctors and lawyers and mailmen and car mechanics and our neighbors, our siblings, our friends. And 70 plus million of them voted. Why? Because they're disaffected, because they don't think Washington speaks to them, because they're worried about globalization and technology. They're worried about, you know, robotics in factories, and they're worried about Amazon and Walmart and these big global companies remaking their towns because you can't have a small business anymore. It's the same thing. You've all lived this with Brexit. It's the same forces. Change can bring out the best in people, and it can also, just human nature, force people to retreat a little bit. A lot of the questions are perfectly legitimate. How politicians respond to them is where sometimes we get led into the dark side or xenophobic tendencies, or to use fear as a motivator as opposed to, you know, a North Star. Here's where we're going. This is going to be tough. There was every hope at the beginning of the Trump administration that he might disrupt Washington in a good way. This town is broken in many ways. That didn't happen. But the disaffection that brought Trump to Washington is not gone. And you could see that in the fact he received so many votes.
And I know the power of Irish America. Look, it's not what it was at all now. And I think Irish Americans are nowadays, they're as likely to vote Republican as Democrat. But do you think Joe Biden's administration, led by a man with Mayo roots, which he talks about a lot, do you think it will be good for Ireland?
I'm certain it will be good for Ireland. Whether, you know, I don't think it's going to unify all Irish Americans. My dad himself, my mom used to fight my dad sometimes. My dad was active in the labor union movement, and he was mostly a Democrat, but I believe he voted for Ronald Reagan once or twice, and mom didn't like that. And so that's fine. A good debate is healthy, right? A good family debate is a healthy thing. But there's no question when it comes to Ireland and when it comes to Europe. I'm not even saying that Trump had any bias against any of these countries, but he just didn't seem to care. It wasn't anti as much as lack of interest in anything outside of the shores of the United States, unless it suited his purpose. And so I do think you'll see much more global involvement. And you're right, Joe Biden loves to stress his Irish roots. And so of all the countries in the world who could think we're going to get more attention, or our phone calls are going to get returned, or the team Biden will pay attention to us, I think Ireland can be very happy.
Second last question, John. Any plans to take advantage, as I read in Time magazine, of your renewed chart throb status? It's good.
This too shall pass. There's often a little brief moments of attention after an election. It's flattering. I'm going to keep doing my job, and I'll be fine.
Do you love what you do? I mean, that came across during all of your coverage. Are you looking forward to the next election?
Oh, too soon. Next election. Wow. I do feel privileged, and I'm grateful for the responsibility that CNN gives me on election nights, because I know a lot of people are watching, and it was off the charts. It was much more dramatic, the interest, than I anticipated. But I also knew it would be very high because of the stakes of the election, because of the pandemic, because of Trumpism. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to do that. And so the fact that people enjoyed it and found it helpful is gratifying to me. I suspect I'll be involved in the next election. But after a few more days at work, I'm planning a little bit of time off. And I'm dead serious that I've been in touch with my cousin Jackie. And as soon as she tells me she thinks it's the right time, I'm going to come visit.
Oh, well, we look forward to that, John. Hopefully I might get to meet you. John King, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's my pleasure. Take care.